please.
Good morning. Paul Seabee on behalf of the state and non-state petitioners. I want to introduce the Attorney General of the State of North Dakota with me at council table, Wayne Stengem. I will speak to the implementation and procedural issues associated with the EPA final rule. Under the Federal Clean Air Act, state-federal partnership, the states have the primary responsibility for implementing the new 1-hour sulfur dioxide standard. Speaking from the perspective of North Dakota and the other petitioning states, with respect to the final rule, EPA has disenfranchised its state partners by failing to subject the new and more stringent implementation approach mandated by the final rule to notice and comment rulemaking. EPA promulgated the 1-hour SO2 ambient standard in June of 2010. It was then, for the first time, that EPA told us that it was changing entirely how states were to go about implementing that standard. Gone was the implementation approach of the past 30 plus years, an implementation approach based on actual measurements of sulfur dioxide concentrations in the ambient air. In June of 2010, we were told that the, quote, traditional, end quote, monitoring-based implementation approach was being replaced by a computer modeling prediction-based.
Do you have the exact words of what you're referring to there? You're not giving me a quote. Now, can you quote the language that you
said? Out of the Federal Register notice?
Yeah.
Sure.
Instead of synopsizing, give me a quote.
Sure, Judge Sentel. EPA's statements in the preamble with respect to the change talk about, for instance, Joint Appendix 148, we intend to use a hybrid analytic approach that would combine the use of monitoring and modeling to assess compliance with the new 1-hour SO2 standard. We believe that for a short-term standard, it is more technically appropriate, efficient, and effective to use modeling as the principal means of assessing compliance. That's 148 as well.
That doesn't exactly match up with the synopsis that you gave, where the gone is the prior approach, and now we'll use only the modeling.
Well, we think it does, because the mandate throughout the final rule, which...
You think the administrator interprets it that way now?
Well, I can speak from this perspective of the states that EPA obviously publicly says it's not a final rule.
Yeah,
and
that's where we're coming to.
Absolutely.
There may be a technology problem here,
but the nature of the change is reflected in the final rule. It's not reflected in the proposed rule because it didn't exist. But in the final rule, we think it's quite clear that talking about this new approach to add the elements and use of modeling-based predictions as the determinative factor. And I'll give you another example of that, is that there's a requirement that modeling can only be used for a state to make an attainment designation. Gone is the opportunity and the discretion for a state to use monitoring data to make the attainment designation. EPA says in the
If you're going to set that, tell us where you're getting that one.
Sure. Joint Appendix 149, any area that has monitoring and appropriate modeling data showing no violations, we would expect to designate as attainment.
Where on 149 is that? Oh, I just found it. First column, midway down.
EPA's position is confirmed in the 21 months following the promulgation of the standard.
Excuse me, just stay with that.
Sure.
Any area that has monitoring and appropriate modeling data showing no violations, we would expect to designate as attainment. That's an initial designation, right?
It is.
But for that does not stand or speak as a requirement of having modeling data. Is that right? It says if you have both, we would expect
be designated.
To designate the area as attainment.
We would, but it goes on to talk about the fact that if you don't have the modeling done, the area is going to be unclassifiable. The converse of that is that you cannot have...
All other areas absent monitoring data and air quality modeling results showing no violations, we would expect to initially designate as unclassified.
That's right.
So it would be the hybrid approach.
That's right. That's right.
That's couched in terms, why is it couched, in, you think, in terms of expectations, rather than just telling you that this is it?
Well, we EPA uses, the, anticipates, believes, and in order to, we intend, that sort of language. And so we think the states looked at that and read it for what it is, because that interpretation has been confirmed by EPA subsequent statements in its training sessions to the states, which were provided with our reply brief information from
now,
that.
Are they in the appendix?
They're in the, they were in the, they're in the appendix materials. And they were also, they were submitted with our reply brief because they occurred after the promulgation of the rule. And they are training sessions that EPA conducted in the 21 months after the rule was promulgated. In addition, EPA provided this court with a copy of its April 12th letter to states that referred to that traditional approach and the change therefrom.
In the 28J letters, hasn't EPA made clear to us that it's no longer requiring the modeling?
We don't think so. We think that that is first of all, it's a non-binding letter. It can't take away what was promulgated as a final rule. Second, EPA could change its position for, say, example, tomorrow or the day after this court issues its opinion in this case. And so that's our
concern.
Could,
but you could challenge that again if they switch back. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I ask EPA about this too, is that a lot of the issues in this case have fallen out because EPA has said that it's not going to require modeling for the 2013.
Well, we're in a bind because when the designation is made, that starts
which has already happened, right?
No, pardon me. When the when the standard is promulgated,
right,
that starts the clock under the federal act for mm-hmm. for certain activities that the state has to do. And the first is to make initial designations.
Right.
And so that's been done. And then the second thing that's coming up is the June 2013 submittals, these what are called infrastructure SIPs.
Right. And on those, you don't have, my understanding is that EPA said it doesn't have to contain modeling demonstrations, or it doesn't have to use modeling. Is that correct, or am I missing?
Well, no, I think that's what the letter says, and it purports to grant a reprieve.
It doesn't answer retrospectively, nor can we, but it answers prospectively your concern about a new requirement of modeling rather than monitoring, doesn't it?
That letter only speaks to the infrastructure SIP, the 2013, but what it doesn't speak to is the designation process.
If I could then, I think that leads us back to it. I was going to take you back to page 149 of the JA just a moment, but what do you read the effect and intent of footnote 22 on that page to be, Council?
EPA in footnote 22 says, uses the word may, allow states
EPA anticipates making the determination of when monitoring alone is appropriate for a specific area on a case-by-case basis informed by the area's factual record as part of the designated process.
Mm-hmm.
And does that not seem to more than strongly suggest that there would be attainments determined without modeling?
Yes, let me speak to that. That's the only...
Now, I'm asking you to speak
absolutely.
To that, yes.
That's the only place in the rule where there's a sense of equivocation where it says may allow monitoring. But the instance mentioned here and then in EPA's draft.
Well, the language, like everything else on that page and in that area, is in terms of expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that you, I don't think the word may be in there somewhere, but the concept you're talking about seems to be run throughout, that this is all a lot more partaking of the nature of may than shall.
Judge, we'll go on and look
maybe
at
what raises this.
The problem with this footnote, though, is the example that it gives is indicative of the problem. And it goes on to say, an example of a situation in which monitoring may be more preferred is a shipping port non-point source or area source that is not in close proximity to other significant stationary SO2 sources. North Dakota doesn't have any of those. So any state that has an SO2 source is not going to be able to...
Does that suggest that this is the only possible usage, or does it say an example?
No, it's an example.
An example. Which would seem to suggest that that's not the only possible, right?
That's right. But then you look at the other provision, other statements in the Federal Register notice, and it's
unless
more...
Unless my colleagues have further questions.
I have one. You didn't finish my question on the designation. I think I said you agreed that for the SIP process in 2013, you don't have to use the modeling is not required. And you said that doesn't help us for the designation process. Can you explain
right.
that further?
It doesn't help us for the designation
which
process.
Which has already occurred, though, right?
We've made initial designation submittals to EPA.
Right.
EPA
so what's the next, what's between now and the SIPs that...
EPA has to act on those, and they will act concurrent with the SIP submittals.
Right.
So
there's nothing, that's already happened, though.
Right. And so...
There's nothing we can really do about that at this point, right?
Well, we have to challenge this now because... first of all, this is a nationally applicable rule, and the Act 307 requires us to challenge it here within a certain time frame. So we have to do that. And it is ripe and justiciable for review because of the immediate consequences that fall on the states that, by EPA's default, come to unclassifiable status unless they're non-attainment. Mm-hmm. And so under this rule, what it means to be unclassifiable imposes immediate consequences on the states, such as developing a plan that uses modeling, the very essence point we're protesting. And so we don't want to do modeling. And in fact, we submitted, Judge, the initial designations based on monitoring. And we did that because that's the only way we can take advantage of a positive judgment from this court. If we do modeling, we lose. We're giving into something we believe, which is a change that EPA can't make without going through notice and comment rulemaking.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, then we'll
thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from your co-petitioner.
Yeah, I just have one for
one more. Excuse me, one yes. more question. You may be up here for quite a while.
I don't think
no
so.
Problem.
With respect to SO2, what exactly is the change that you're discussing? I mean, the historical practice really refers to one previous designation, right, with the original NAAQS.
The historical practice that we're talking about and that EPA has recognized is, you can see it in the proposed rule, where there's a lengthy discussion of the practice of EPA working with states, and states like North Dakota invested in a tremendous amount of these monitors. They did it because we're state regulators and we administer, have primary jurisdiction over a number of these Clean Air Act programs, such as the permitting of new or modified.
We've been engaging in monitoring for a long time.
We've been using monitoring for a long time.
But the EPA's promulgation of the rule that required or allowed monitoring was the one time, what, in 1970?
No, it's been the tradition of the administration of the entire program for 30-plus years.
I'm not talking about the administration. I'm talking about the promulgation of the rules that govern this.
Yes.
How many times have there been rules governing this from which they're now departing? Isn't the answer one?
Yes, and it started the historical tradition that's continued up until June of 2010.
Well, one time when the first NAAQS were put out, early in the history of the Clean Air Act, they said monitor.
Yes.
And the historical practice is that you've been monitoring all along under that regime.
Exactly.
Yeah, one rule.
Yes.
Now they proposed more extensive monitoring, drew back from that, and pushed modeling as an alternative.
Not as an alternative, as an additional.
Well, in some cases it's a supplement, depending on the context.
Well, we think it's the cornerstone. I mean, there are plenty of places cited in the brief with respect to the Federal Register notice, the final rule, where EPA...
I just wanted to be clear that practice has been longstanding, but it's under one prior promulgation.
That's right.
I'd like to hear the rest of the sentence there, and there are plenty of places cited in the brief where what?
Sorry.
Where there's a discussion of the history both articulated and acknowledged by EPA, mm-hmm. as well as the instances they cited in their opening brief where they purported to suggest that modeling has always been part of the same tradition.
I'm not sure how that differs from simply what is true in case after case that we get, where there is a rule That rule is followed by a period of time, and then there's another rule. I don't know what the discussion of the tradition adds to that.
Well, it's a longstanding rule. It's a longstanding
rule. Suggests, and then eventually you have another rule that may or may not change what it says.
I guess I can synopsize it very quickly. There was a beginning rule, 30-plus years of the administrative practice under that rule between the states and the federal government as partners under the Federal Clean Air Act. EPA changed that, not by proposing the change, but by adopting it in a final rule that no one had any notice of and the ability to comment on.
The only issue left then would be finality. And again, in your brief, you used the term from cases of ours that they received marching orders. And the marching orders, or is that the language on JA 128 that you're talking about? Or, and that's the best you've got on marching orders?
Well, we have, on marching orders, we have all of the statements in the final rule where EPA, where we, and we're using the word expectation, imposed on us, the states, who have obligations under the Act in a certain time period to do things. And EPA tells us that in the final rule and in guidance and training sessions and so forth, and most recently to the court, recognizing that tradition and what was in the final rule and easing back on it, purporting to ease back on it in a non-binding fashion. The totality of all of those things, I think, make clear that that was the expectation in the final rule. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. The expectation, again, is the tone rather than mandate, though, right?
Well, that's right. That's what I meant by the totality of those things. That's what we hear as states that have to.
Normally, when we use marching orders, we have something in there that says shall. And the areas you cite in connection with marching orders seem to have expectations here.
I agree. They occur in various places in the final rule.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the co-petitioner.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors. My name is Mark DeLaQuill, and I'll be arguing the challenges to the standard itself on behalf of the industry petitioners. EPA failed to adequately explain how it set the revised sulfur dioxide ambient air quality standard at the requisite level, and as a result, it will cause significant economic dislocation and uncertainty without commensurate benefits to public health.
I want to make sure I properly understand. Now, these two issues are totally independent of each other, right?
They are almost totally independent of each other, Your Honor. We believe that modeling can affect the stringency of the standard, and it's one of the reasons why EPA's failure to notice and comment it was prejudicial. Okay. Otherwise, they're separate. EPA made three fundamental errors in the final rule and in these proceedings. First, EPA's explanation for its reliance on key clinical studies was unreasonable because it selected the respiratory decreases and credited them, but failed to explain away the respiratory improvements that study subjects showed. Second, EPA offered a post hoc rationalization for the rule that shifted the emphasis for what it relied on in setting the standard from an equal parts controlled human studies and epidemiology to the epidemiology itself. Third, EPA failed to consider what we believe is the most important criteria in determining whether to revise the NAAQS, current air quality as it stands today, in making that decision. With respect to the first error, that EPA's explanation for its reliance on the clinical studies was unreasonable because it credited the bad results while disregarding the good results, it's important to recognize the role that natural variations in lung functioning play in these asthmatic studies.
Now, would that have been addressed by the EPA's use of the multi-factor regression?
Your Honor, it would not be addressed by that. EPA recognized that in the key clinical studies it relied on to set the standards, that the results were not statistically significant at 200 and 300 parts per billion, the level it relied on. So it's not addressed by that.
Is that not two different questions, statistical significance and multi-factor regression?
I don't believe
I'm not saying they're unrelated, but you can have a statistical significance without having multifactor regression, can't you?
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, they're not co-determinative. So why would that answer my question as to whether this retrogression, multifactor retrogression, addressed the problem that you're now raising about consideration of the outliers?
I believe, Your Honor, that that didn't address it for two primary reasons. First is that there's a fundamental question of causation that must be addressed before EPA basically used the multifactor regression to purport to find a group of asthmatics that was sensitive at a higher level, but not at 200 to 300 parts per billion. And that's the issue of variability, that some of the study subjects, in fact, approximately half of the subjects who were affected showed respiratory improvements. Approximately half that were affected showed respiratory decreases. The decreases weren't statistically significant. What that shows to us is that the elephant in the room is natural variation in lung function. That wasn't addressed at all. It's shown in the respiratory improvements. EPA's explanations, including the regression, attribute all of the decreases to the sulfur dioxide. We believe that that is simply an unreasonable explanation and should be set aside, Your Honor. With respect to the second error, the EPA offered post hoc rationalizations for the rule in litigation. EPA set the level of the standard by placing quote-unquote primary emphasis, that's on page 143 of the appendix, on the controlled human studies and the clinical studies. The EPA's basis for the rule has two legs, and it cannot stand on one. In the briefs, EPA argued that the epidemiological studies were quote-unquote decisive, that's on page 49 of their final brief, and that they actually bolstered the controlled human studies. We don't believe this is consistent with the rationale they offered in the final rule. In fact, EPA did the opposite in the final rule. It relied on the clinical studies to bolster the epidemiological studies. The epidemiological studies were frustrated by what EPA coined a major methodological issue about the extent to which sulfur dioxide was causing the effects shown in the studies and the extent to which other pollutants were. As a result, EPA determined, again in its own words, that these studies should not be considered in a vacuum and that it would not rely solely on them in reaching the result. We believe this case must be decided based on the rationale that EPA presented in the final rule. As a result, we believe the key clinical human studies are the key to this case. And to the extent EPA's representations in litigation evidence confusion in the final rule, we believe that's independently a ground to remand the decision. With respect to
when you say the rule cannot rest on either of the two legs alone, epidemiological or clinical evidence, is that because you're saying that the decision invoked both? And therefore, if either one is invalid, it has to go back? Or are you saying that if they had been invoked disjunctively, neither one would suffice?
Your Honor, we're saying the former potentially. Under the Chenery principle,
exactly,
the court can only
hold. That's what I thought. Okay, yes. Thank you.
With respect to the third point, Your Honor, what EPA failed to consider air quality as it stands today, or as it stood at the time the rulemaking was occurring, in determining whether to revise the NAAQS, we believe there's no factor that's more appropriate in determining whether to revise the NAAQS or not than current air quality. We don't believe there's any provision in the Clean Air Act that precludes EPA from taking that into account, and that Section 109D1's use of the phrase, as may be appropriate, grants EPA that discretion. Moreover, we believe that this reading of the Act makes good policy sense, that the NAAQS are established in a two-step framework. They're set at the level that's requisite to protect public health while allowing an adequate margin of safety. And second, EPA then determines whether or not it may be appropriate to revise them in accordance with the statutes in Section 109B and Section 108. If Congress did not intend the term as appropriate, as may be appropriate, to grant them discretion, it would not have used that. This would allow EPA to prioritize its resources to instances, NAAQS revisions, other deadlines under the Act, where it would create the greatest benefits to act. EPA failed to consider them. And it's important to note that EPA responded to a different argument in its brief that we made. EPA said it was precluded from revising the NAAQS as a result of Congress's design, and that we're arguing it was precluded to do so because it would not result in many public health benefits. That may be the case, but we're arguing that this is fundamentally a question of discretion. EPA had discretion to consider it. It was properly
now
presented.
The it that they had discretion to consider was?
Current air quality. As it stood today, the Clean Air Act programs that maintain it and ensure that air quality, like the Title IV acid rain program.
So the it includes not only the current quality, but the programs
but
that
the
are
programs.
In place.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe these are directly related to public health and are the types of things that EPA should be considering in determining whether
should
or not
be
it's
or
appropriate.
Has to.
Has to, because they were properly presented in the administrative record, and under the State Farm principle, the agency is charged with considering all relevant factors brought to its attention. And under this court's line of cases, starting with Prill versus National Labor Relations Board, an agency's failure to exercise that discretion because it incorrectly believed it was precluded from doing so by the statute is grounds to set its decision aside. Thank you, Your Honors. Do you have any further questions for me?
Counsel. Questions? If not, then we'll hear from the government. Thank you. Again, we'll see about giving back a couple of minutes for rebuttal to each petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors. Norman Rave from the Department of Justice. With me at council table are Steve Silverman and Mike Thrift of EPA's Office of General Counsel. I'd like to just address the issue of level first, if that's okay with the court. EPA's decision to establish the level is based on the record as a whole, and it's EPA's rationale for setting the standard is laid out in great detail in the joint appendix at pages 143 and 145, and that where the administrator walks through the various types of studies in the record and demonstrates how they led to establishment of the 75 parts per billion standard. And they clearly demonstrate that while EPA considered the entire record, the actual value of 75 parts per billion is based on the epidemiologic studies. The agency discusses the clinical studies, and this is on again on page 143 to 144, and determines that that there are adverse effects demonstrated down to 200 parts per billion, which was also case at the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee specifically told EPA that it strongly believed that the clinical studies, the studies that petitioners are challenged, demonstrated adverse health effects down to 200 parts per billion. And EPA, you know, on that basis and on its own analysis, determined that that was the threshold it should consider. This court has, you know, routinely recognized that KSAC's recommendations are due to considerable deference, and the statute also recognizes that, requiring EPA to explain any departures from KSAC's recommendations. And in this case, KSAC, in response to an earlier draft set by EPA in which it had limited its analysis down to the 400 parts per billion level, criticized the agency and strongly recommended that that 200 parts per billion was the appropriate level to see. And that's the level at which there is this noise in the data, where there are some improvements, but there are also significant numbers of people who show decrements. And EPA, you know, analyzed that data. It responded to it in the record. It showed that, first of all, that it recognized that the studies probably underestimated the effects because they didn't include anybody with significant or serious asthma or severe asthma, because they weren't included in the studies. And they also found that there is a by sort of analyzing people throughout the studies, people who were exposed to different levels, found that people who tended to respond at the 400 level were the same people who responded at the 200 level, indicating that there is a specific subpopulation of asthmatics that's sensitive to SO2. And when this court remanded the SO2 decision back to us in American Lung Association, it was specifically to consider the effects of short-term exposures to SO2 on asthmatics. And so that's what the agency is focused on here.
I could move you up to a more macro level on this. What do you say to the argument that the EPA did not properly consider current air quality levels and programs?
Well, it did consider it, Your Honor. I mean, and in fact, the agency specifically found that adverse health effects due to SO2 levels are occurring under current conditions and in areas that meet the current standard, which those are epidemiologic studies. We cite a number of them in our brief, and they conclusively demonstrate that the current standard is not protective. The statute, 109D1, says, as appropriate in accordance with the standards of 109B, 109B says that the standard has to be requisite to protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. And the data in the record demonstrates that current ambient levels in areas that are meeting the standard are not adequately protective. So simply as a factual matter, the agency did consider whether ambient levels of SO2 were adequately protected and determined that they're not. Their effects are seen. Moreover, the statute says that the standard must be protective. EPA would not be meeting its statutory requirement if it said, you know, well, we need a more stringent standard, but, you know, we just don't want to change it, or we think, you know, at the moment things are okay. The standard has to be protective, and by making the standard protective, it ensures against any future changes to air quality. So the agency did consider that issue. Back on the issue of what the rationale was for setting the standard and the relationship between the epidemiologic studies, again, I'm going back to the discussion on JA 143 to 145. The administrator found that the clinical studies would have a standard of 100 parts per billion, would bring down exposures to the 200 level. But then the agency considered the peer-reviewed epidemiological studies. There are more than 50 of them in the record. They almost all show positive relationships between health effects, such as respiratory-related emergency room visits and hospitalizations with SO2. And the agency focused on three of those studies that used multi-pollutant models to address this issue of confounding. And in those three studies, the SO2 effect remained statistically significant when considered with particulate matter. And that's the most significant, most likely confounder, because SO2 in the air is converted to SO4 and then becomes particulate matter. SO2 is a fairly short-lived pollutant. But it's because it's very reactive. And the most likely confounder, the most likely thing to be running at the same rough rates would be particulate matter. So the agency looked at other pollutants as well. But these three models showed significant effects, with ambient air down at levels of 78, 82, and 150 parts per billion. And the agency set the standard at 75, which was just below that level. This is the analogous to the way the agency set the PM2.5 standard, the court upheld in the American Trucking ATA 3 opinion, where the agency in that case set the standard at just below the level at which epidemiologic studies had shown a statistically significant relationship between particulate matter and health effects. The court upheld it. Here, evidence is a lot stronger. Here we have many more studies that have used multi-pollutant models to demonstrate the effect of SO2, and we have the body of clinical studies which also demonstrate, because in the clinical studies the subjects are only being exposed to SO2, demonstrate that the effects are in fact due to SO2. So the agency did in fact address, I think I've addressed all three of petitioner's points.
I think you have. I was going to say, unless my colleagues have questions, you may wish to move to the other issue.
Okay, I will do that. On the issue of implementation, I think it's important to note, Your Honor, that there are really two separate issues here that the petitioners are challenged. And
we've got that. Yeah.
Okay. One is the issue of whether modeling would be, of how initial designations would be done. And the agency in the proposal had proposed an expanded monitoring network. And the reason it proposed an expanded monitoring network was because it was to rely on monitoring would be a change from the approach the agency has been historically using. One of the documents that petitioners have assiduously ignored that we cited in our brief is EPA's 1994 guidance on how attainment with the SO2 standard is to be addressed. And in that guidance document, the agency stated, this is cited in our brief at page 23, it cited for SO2 attainment demonstrations, monitoring data alone will generally not be adequate. And that guidance explains that because of the nature of SO2, the number of sources, the fact that it varies, the highest concentrations vary depending on the meteorology, et cetera, that monitoring, unless you have an extremely extensive network of monitors, is not sufficient. So the agency's approach, and the approach the agency has utilized in making attainment demonstrations, which have to be when the agency redesignates an area in terms of looking at SIP submissions, it uses modeling. That was also the subject of our first Rule 28J letter, the Ninth Circuit decision in MMSC. One of the issues there was the agency's use of modeling in SO2, and the court upheld EPA's use. So the agency's practice has always been to use modeling. The original designations were made somewhat back in the 70s. As we point out, we cite to several in our brief, were based on a combination of monitoring and modeling. Since then, the agency has more and more come use modeling, and certainly the practice as of the 1994 guidance and its implementing since then has been the use of modeling. What was proposed in the proposal was a change to move towards a system relying more on monitoring. The agency received comments that the expanded monitoring system would both be too expensive to implement and still not enough to do the job adequately, determine whether areas were truly in attainment or not, but at the same time, too expensive.
Can I ask you a question about this? With the new NACs out there, the issue for each county or area is now an initial designation, isn't that right?
That's correct.
The designation under the prior NACs is not relevant anymore.
That's correct.
Okay. So, insofar as the rule either governs or gives guidance about redesignations, that's going to arise only sometime in the future after an initial designation. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But it still gives guidance to how the agency believes. I mean, to do a designation, that's a determination of whether an area is attaining the NACs or not.
The initial, right.
Initial designation.
Yes. Right.
So it's the same analysis as would be done in the future as determine whether it's being redesignated. It's the same process.
No difference. Okay. I thought there was a greater showing required for redesignation.
The difference that's required in a redesignation, for instance, if you redesignate from non-attainment to attainment, there are things that have to be shown in addition to the modeling and the data showing that the area is attaining. You have to show that there are control measures in place.
So those are not in dispute here.
Those are not relevant here. So as I think the discussion with Petitioner's Counsel brought out, this is what the agency said here is that this is a case-by-case determination. Our belief, our technical belief, as we have stated repeatedly for many years, is that modeling is the appropriate way to gauge attainment with the SO2, but we always look at a combination of whatever monitoring data is appropriate. And I think the language that you, Judge Santel, was referring to in the preamble talks about that it's a hybrid approach. It uses whatever combination of monitoring and modeling is appropriate for a given area, and those decisions are made on a case-by-case basis.
You're not contending, are you, that there is nothing new in what the EPA is doing now as opposed to what it did 30 years ago in the prior rule, are you? here.
There has certainly have been developments in modeling and practice. There's nothing regulatorily that's new.
This regulatory action is what we're reviewing in this case.
That's right, Your Honor.
You're not contending there is no change between the prior rule and the present issuance, are you? Or are you?
There's no. Each case, the decisions have been made on a case-by-case basis for individual state submissions based
on the status. If this had not been issued, you would be doing the same thing without this? Without this decision
without
we're
this
reviewing?
Well, the decision was established the NAAQS. And certainly the NAAQS is completely different. Mm-hmm. But the process of implementing the NAAQS with discussion in the preamble has not changed.
You say there is no difference in process now than there was before. You understand what I'm trying to find is if there is a finality here in something the agency has done, which makes this ready for review, and as to which there was not a proper notice given or not a proper process followed. I understand,
Your Honor. And the answer is no. The agency is, these are done on a case-by-case basis, and the agency is continuing the practice that has been following for many years in terms of how to make these.
So what was the agency's purpose in putting this out?
Well, it was basically to say that we were not adopting the change that we proposed in the proposal. The proposal would have been a change. In the proposal, the agency proposed to change its approach to put much more emphasis on monitoring and, as a result, to require a much more extensive monitoring network. This explanation was to say why we were not finalizing what was in the proposal and saying that we were going to address it while recognizing that the agency has to put out guidance on how to do the modeling for the one-hour standard, which is why the expectation is that so many areas will be designated as unclassifiable, because the agency, this is a new standard, the modeling has to be adjusted, there has to be some guidance on that.
So if you could write the opinion for us on this issue, you would be saying this is not final for review.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Would you be saying that it's moot?
I would also say it's moot because they don't have, to the extent that they want to do designations, their argument was that we were dictating how they had to do their designations.
That doesn't cover the whole of the matter, right?
It does on this particular issue. Then there's the second issue, which is the what's required of the SIP submissions. But that's an entirely different issue. That issue.
As to that, EPA's got a new approach, right? You tell me what the April 19th letter you sent to the court means.
Well, the April 19th letter says that we are not going, essentially not finalizing the approach that we had intended to take in the proposal. Mm-hmm. In the preamble, the agency said that because so many areas are going to be unclassifiable, the agency intended to require a more stringent showing that they were going to come into attainment than it normally does, because under most NAAQS, areas typically.
So it's moot as to the designations, not final, and in any event, nothing, whatever was discussed in the briefs on the SIPs is gone because EPA has changed its approach since?
It hasn't finalized the approach that it intended to take.
So you'd stick it into the not final categories.
Well, it's not.
It's further evidence of not.
In the final rule, the agency said this would be its intended approach, but it also said it would put out draft guidance and take comment on draft guidance. The agency did put out draft guidance. In the draft guidance, the agency said that it was contemplating doing a rulemaking to address some of these issues. None of these are indicia of finality. When the agency is putting out drafts, when the agency is putting out taking comments, when the agency is expressing a need for rulemaking, those are not indicia of final agency action.
Rafe, can the court really take account of this letter that you've now sent to the court? I mean, the letter you've sent to the states and copied the court through the 20HA process. It's a post-record matter.
Yeah.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you don't really expect us to take that into account, do you? Or can we? Should we?
Well, I think the court can take it into account in the sense that I believe it. If the court were to find that there had been a final action, I think it's now moot because the letter to the states, if there was something final, it's now been withdrawn. So I believe the letter would make the matter moot.
If we were going to moot something on the basis of post-record occurrences rather than ruling in the favor of the agency, would that not mean we would have to remand for the making of a further record? What comes to us in a 28J record is not the record.
No, that's, you're right, Your Honor.
We're to decide generally on the record. Now, we could, I suppose, welcome affidavits to verify what everybody knows about whatever happened with respect to the matter in the 28J letters, but would it not be, are you not sort of inviting us to remand, if not vacate and remand, when you ask us to take post-record conduct into account?
No, Your Honor. In fact,
can we decide a case on this post-record matter?
No, Your Honor. I think it's simply informative for the court, and it also responds to, you know, the numerous post-record documents that were submitted as petitioners.
I understood you to say the case would be mooted, and I understood that originally to be part of what you might have been saying. And I'm not sure, could we decide a case to be moot on the basis of post-record conduct that's not in record? Wouldn't we have to send it back for additional record-making?
Well, Your Honor, I think the cases always become moot after they occur, so they're always post-record. And I think if the agency, if the facts are sufficiently clear.
No, that is not by any means correct. We get cases that have been moot long before they were filed at times.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, but certainly they become moot after the record is closed. After the record.
But you didn't move to reopen the record.
No, Your Honor, we did not.
You didn't supplement the record. You sent us a 28J, which is fine. I mean, it puts us on notice of these events,
right.
But the procedural force of it may be less than in another.
That's true, Your Honor. And frankly, Your Honor, we think the court can easily decide this case on the statements that made in the so we're not relying on that document. We simply pointing it out.
If this had been a case coming to us from the district court, your voluntary cessation of the activities of which the petitioner complains would require us to say not only that the case is moot, but to vacate the judgment of the district court under Munsingware. I don't know why we wouldn't have to vacate the order.
Well, I don't think there's no order here to vacate, Your Honor. It was simply the discussion in the preamble. And I don't know
there's an order issuing that discussion. I mean, isn't that correct?
Well, again, that's the whole issue. In fact, what I think is most relevant, the 28J letter is most relevant as sort of further evidence that it wasn't final action, that it wasn't the consummation of the agency.
Well, that opens the court up to manipulation by any agency that thinks it's got a bad case when somebody takes an appeal.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but I think it's entirely consistent with the court can decide the case based on the language in the Federal Register itself. The Federal Register says.
The question is whether we don't really have to, don't we have to decide it solely on that basis?
I would agree, Your Honor. However, I do note that a number of the court's cases considering whether something is final agency action or not do often look beyond the record in terms of how something's been implemented. And so the court's precedents are a little unclear on that position, Your Honor.
But I don't fault you for submitting the 28J letter and keeping the court apprised.
But certainly our view would be that the court should decide the case on the record and exclude the extra record material submitted by both petitioners and the agency.
Thank you.
We have 2 minutes to each of petitioners for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. A couple of points. If EPA always used modeling and so strongly relied upon modeling historically, you would have expected to see such a discussion of that in the proposal. Instead, you see only an extensive discussion of the monitoring-based approach to the program and EPA's proposed expansion of that. As for the 1994 guidance Mr. Rave cited to the court, it was just that. It's only guidance. It also spoke in the context of redesignations, not initial designations. Judge Santel, in response to your questions about footnote 22 and the example cited in there and the others, that there might be other requirements or other instances when modeling wasn't required, monitoring could be. We in the states obviously looked at that and were waiting for more guidance and wanted to know what the other examples were and what the limitations were apart from what it says in the final rule. And EPA told us in draft guidance it issued last fall. At that time, EPA said the only circumstance in which modeling need not be done is in areas where there are no large sources of SO2. And again, that's not us state petitioners. We have large sources of SO2, and that's why we installed such and invested in, with EPA's concurrence and participation, such an extensive monitoring data. We wanted to know actual air quality. That's at Joint Appendix 1841 is that draft guidance, where it says the when modeling is not required, and that's only when you don't have any of these sources. Well, we do.
I don't have that volume on the bench with me, but I'll look at it when we go back and count.
Sure. Again, Judge, that's Joint Appendix 1841.
This is one of those days when we didn't have a wheelbarrow large.
right. And so what we as states need to know is what the process is when EPA keeps changing its mind. And we think that Section 307 of the D of the Clean Air Act requires them to go through notice and comment when they change their position as to the expectations of their state partners for implementing the state, the National Ambient Air Quality Programs as the Act vests us with that responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll hear from the co-petitioner for a maximum of 2 minutes.
4 points very quickly. EPA suggests that it relied on CASAC and the record as a whole, but the NAAQS are a very important matter. EPA anticipated this NAAQS would...
Can I ask you to speak up just a bit?
Yes. EPA suggests that relied on CASAC's advice and the record on the whole as reaching this decision. The NAAQS are a very important matter. EPA expects this one will impose $1.5 billion in costs on the industry. That's why they entrusted this judgment to a politically accountable administrator, not to the body of CASAC. As to the question of whether EPA relied on the record as a whole as opposed to the clinical studies at 200 to 300 parts per billion, we think it's clear they relied on the 200 to 300 parts per billion clinical studies and that that's clear from the record. Joint Appendix 126, 128, 143, 144, Note 19. And that's the final rule. In the risk and exposure assessment, Joint Appendix 242, 271, 383. In the integrated science assessment, Joint Appendix 1452, 1459. We think that's the only fair reading of the record. EPA suggested the American Lung Association remand of its 1996 decision was because it didn't consider effects on asthmatics. We don't think that's correct. EPA concluded there that the effects were localized, infrequent, and transient, and didn't amount to a public health problem as a result. I think it's completely different. EPA suggests this is just ATA 3 all over again as a result of the reliance on the clinical studies to validate the epidemiological studies, not a factor of that particulate matter rulemaking or ozone rulemaking. That's just not the case. Finally, EPA suggests that it did consider current air quality. I direct you to the passage bridging the gap between pages 130 and 131 of the Joint Appendix. The final rule, EPA was very clear that it did not and would not consider current air quality as a basis for its decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Once again, we'll take a brief recess.